the job summit, the report is out, and where social partners and have agreed to certain issues, and then we try and get some sort of presentation on that agreement. Honorable members, I think you'll remember as well that immediately or hot on the heels of the job summit was an investment summit. And the investment summit, in one way or another, is supposed to be supporting the job summit agreement. And then we'll hear from the department, although that I'm not sure we may not be having outcomes of that investment summit, but all of us we have heard, and I think the department should be having some sort of more information on the outcomes of the investment summit, and where on the part of the investment summit that seeks to support the job summit, then we'll hear. And other than that, we have got documents that will be presented to ourselves, but for us to process further and to take to our caucuses and the rest, and try and add some information to that, and then that is in relation to the legacy report and an annual report of the committee. The intention is not to finalize the documents today. It's almost like an introduction for us to be able to go and do work with our respective caucuses. And then otherwise, then it is a set of minutes. That is what it is in front of us. We are having the department to do this work in front of us. And I know today that there is a cabinet meeting, but it would have been far much better if we had the minister here. If we had the minister, because we would have loved to also hear, other than the bureaucratic technical report of the job summit, also the political report on it. Political context. We are politicians, we are not administrators. But the unfortunate part is that it looks like the minister is not here. We will hear from the delegation. We have in the delegation from the department led by Uegumuido, who's the acting DG today. And then you've got Vigil Seafield, the DGG. And then we've got Advocate Nclek. And then we've got Matabo. Where is Advocate Nclek?
Yeah.
Oh, the one that's getting in. Okay. There is one person that keeps on sending me emails from that side of Bophuthatswana, the old Bophuthatswana. You know him?
Yeah.
Please sort out that man. Sort out before we call him to come here and embarrass him. Sort out that man and then give us an indication what it is that's supposed to happen. You see? That was just in passing, but it's official. I'm not gossiping. You see. So it's members of members that have apologized. Yes.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair, and good morning to the members and the department. Chair, I've received the following apologies from Honorable Mutambi, who is attending a broad week. Mr. Muteka, who is sick, Mr. Kwarai, who is attending human settlement, and Mr. Bagren, who said he cannot make it today. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And An interesting one is the apology of Honorable Bagram. It looks like of late is either Bagram is here and America is not here, or the other way around. They are now swapping for the last few meetings. I hope that they'll get over it. Okay, no, thanks. Those are the apologies that we have received. And then anybody to move for the adoption of the agenda, unless otherwise there is something that needs to be dealt with on the agenda.
We don't correct, so that's me.
Come again?
I'm saying we don't correct, so we can...
Say we don't correct?
We do.
Yeah, so...
No, remember that is not the original meeting of COVID. It's not the original meeting of
COVID.
Okay, Honorable America moves for adoption of the agenda, and then Honorable Jobo is seconding. Honourable members, just before we get to the job summit, I just want to indicate that information came to me that the Human Rights Commission has produced a report that seeks to question the affirmative action and the employment equity policy. And then we will try and access that report and make sure that honorable members receive it. And then if that is 100% correct, we may need to invite that the Human Rights Commission for them to brief us what is there that they think is dear Megar with the affirmative action. Because as far as I'm concerned is that when affirmative action policy came up, then it has been tested many times in law. And it was found to be constitutional to a certain extent. Whether the ball game has changed, I don't know. Then they can only explain to us is what, so that we just get informed from the horse's mouth. So thank you very much. And then the department, I hope that you are ready. I, like as I said, I know that the investment summit, it was not wholly in your domain. It was not wholly in your domain, like the job summit. But you will indicate to us is whether the report of the investment summit is out or not out, that we can have, we can access it. And then Ms. Ejimilo.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity to engage on the job summit framework. And I think you're quite spot on when you just upon the investment summit or the job summit, I believe when they're like two sides of the same coin, because at the center of both of them is the whole issue of unlocking job creating opportunities. And Chairperson, allow me to also introduce people that work through after they acknowledge the delegation from the department, Mr. Eric Nkemba, as well as Mr. Honorable Mchikina, both from the ministry. And then we just need the gentleman behind us, Temple Chende, from the ministry as well. And also allow me to formally register the apology of the Director General. Mr. Lamas is still out of the country in Geneva attending the governing body meeting. Chairperson, regarding the availability of the report of the investment summit, I'm not aware whether it is available. And Mr. Vegas Sifford is going to take us through the presentation. Obviously, you will find that there's a golden thread between the job summit as well as the investment summit, like I said earlier also. At this point, I'm going to hand over to Mr. Sifford.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning.
Proceed.
Sorry, the Chair just nearly gave in. I didn't
No, you won't be the first one.
And good morning, honourable members and colleagues around the table. Chair, just to before I touch on the job summit and start with it, I want to touch on one or two issues that you raised in your introduction, Chair. Firstly, that the investment summit report is not out yet, but we will provide the honourable committee with the investment report the minute that we investment report the minute that we get the investment report. Secondly, you touched on the issue on the the Human Rights Commission report on the constitutionality of affirmative action. Just as an introduction, we wrote to the Human Rights Commission to withdraw the announcement that they made on the constitutionality of affirmative action, because we feel that it does not fall within their remit to address constitutionality issues around the legislation. Similar to the report on the public protector raised in relationship to the extent of the remit of the Reserve Bank in terms of the findings, we feel that the Human Rights Commission should withdraw the section of the report. Alternatively, as it stands, the Human Rights Section 9 Committee, and therefore if they do not withdraw this report, we will have to challenge it in court. We have already drafted papers and we've consulted our legal services to draft papers in this regard, and we hope that we will be able to deal with this matter. Our position to this is that you are absolutely right, Chief, that the constitutionality of our legislation has been tested, it has been put up for constitutional muster, and therefore we feel that what we have in the legislation currently is would withstand constitutional muster. That's the first point. Chair, again, then returning to the job summit report, I just want to point out that there's a number of things that preempted the job summit report. One of these is to check whether a number of initiatives by government fall within the same kind of framework, and whether we deal with these in the context of all of the other initiatives of government, whether it's the 9-point plan, whether it's the NDF, whether it's the stimulus package that the president has announced, and whether it is the job investment summit imperatives that were raised in establishing the underlying principles for having an investment summit, and that we are of the opinion that all of these initiatives talks to the job creation limitations that South Africa has, talks to the investment limitations that South Africa has, and talks to the ability of the economy to grow and investment to grow in the country, and therefore a number of initiatives that we put on the table, both in the job summit, investment summit, stimulus package, was to see to what extent we could stimulate the South African economy at some point too, in order to grow, in order to raise the necessary investment, address the issue of an investment strike, the so-called investment strike in South Africa, and talk to the issues about attracting foreign direct investment in order to address the concern that we have, both in terms of growing the economy, stimulating the ability of the economy that we currently have to create the kind of jobs that we have, that we require, and then also to see to what extent we can grow foreign direct investment. So our biggest challenge in South Africa currently is the ability in terms of the Department of Labour and in terms of our people is to grow employment. Currently, we sit with an unemployment rate of 27.7%, which is not only as a result of the economy that is not creating jobs. The economy is creating jobs, but the ability of the economy to absorb the number of job entrants into the economy is restrained by a number of factors, and I've alluded to those factors. The inability of the economy to grow and create a kind of job. So that's how critical problem in South Africa. The second issue is that sometimes we shoot ourselves, we shoot our own goals, we shoot ourselves in the foot by the kind of policies that we put out shape. So there's a lot of policy inconsistencies that we've identified. That within the context of the job, whilst it is not necessarily related to employment growth, it inhibits the ability of the economy to grow. There's, for example, the issue on visa regulation. Now, you would suppose the Minister of Home Affairs addressed a number of measures to address this issue of visa regulation that we have. But it's a critical element of growing, for example, the tourism sector. Why do I, as a parent, have to have a letter that says that this child is mine and this child can grow, can travel with me when I come from the UK? It has impacted so much on our tourism industry that there are measures there are measurements in terms of relationship to the size of the impact of this. The migration regime that we currently have. That's the one area of the scope of the problem. The second scope of the problem is that we require investors to, every time that they enter the country in order to seek investment, to apply for a visa. Why do we have this onerous regulation for people that are willing to invest in our country, but they have to go through all of these things? So the the migration regime, as an example of this policy uncertainty. There are other issues of policy uncertainty that we have. We know that the agricultural sector, as an example, has the ability to create jobs. It's not a sunset industry. The mining industry is not a sunset sector as all people would want to put on the table. There are opportunities and there are job opportunities that we can create through this, whether it's in relationship to the primary production or whether it's in the relationship to beneficiation in relationship to all of these industries. So there are job opportunities that we have, but the policy uncertainty that we put on the table for ourselves are those issues that we want to address. And there's a host of others. There's, for example, the water licensing regime that we have in South Africa, where you in the agricultural sector have to wait for 5 years, as an example, for a water license if you want to utilize the water that runs through your farm, as an example. In order to use that water, you have to apply for a water license, and in order to do that as a micro farmer, for example, you have to wait 5 years for a license to utilize that water. So these are things that we want to address in relationship to policy uncertainty and inconsistency. There's a host of other regimes that we need to look at in relationship to do. So in the context of those, the jobs that we wanted to create that we have been created over the past couple of years in the country, and there's a report that we put out as a job summit group. In relationship to what are the number of jobs that have been created in the economy as it stands without the impact of the job summit in terms of that, and not kept pace with what we require in the country. Then we have this notion that many people and we spoke about in a number of portfolio committees about the youth unemployment vouch that we have. And we have this notion that the youth lack the skills that we require and work experience needed to find these kinds of jobs. And we have to address these in the reality, whilst we have hundreds and thousands of youth that sit with degrees, qualifications, but it does not match the requirements of the economy. And how do we deal with those realities? How do we deal with the output of the TVET colleges in relationship to what is required in the industry, so that we don't have this argument that says that the youth does not match the skills that we require in this. So we've been, and I won't go through the process, but I think it's important that we touch on the process of arriving at the job summit, because in this instance, it is a social pact, if you will, by the social partners. that we have that underpins the job summit agreement, the framework agreement that we have in terms of the job that we want to create in the country. So we've clustered the outcomes of the job summit in five key intervention areas that we think we will lead to job creation and job retention. So the next couple of slides that we will have, that we will deal with, Chair, deal with the issues of those five clusters that we put together in terms of the job summit that we have. The first area is economic sector specification. One of the things that we've realized from the outset of the discussion is that we need to grow the economy. We cannot have the economy not growing, so that it needs to create a space for job creation, if you will. So the one thing that we touched on is about local procurement, Chair. I can bet you, Chair, that if I go around the table and look at where your clothes have been manufactured, not 5% of the clothes that we wear in this room is manufactured in South Africa. I'm looking at Mr. Nyakembe, but I won't use him as an example. In terms of the clothes that are manufactured around. But it's got to be about public procurement and private procurement in the country. So the government has made a commitment in terms of local procurement. How does public sector local procurement fit within the picture? So we have banks as an example, and it will talk to a host of these things. Banks, if you look at AXA as an example, their whole layout of the service in delivery entrance in it has changed completely. F&B has changed completely in terms of it. So what we're saying, for example, in terms of banking, when you procure furniture for all of these events that you have, there should be an area of local procurement that you do. If you purchase furniture for all of these, where do you procure these furniture, as an example, in terms of that? So when we, for example, develop engines in South Africa, I'm looking at a second bullet point that we have. Diesel engines in South Africa or trucks in South Africa, and when we have FAW as a production of trucks in South Africa in Port Elizabeth if we have them there, what is the content of local procurement within those vehicles that is South African, and how do we get that? So one of the things, again, about policy uncertainty that we have, we're very slow in terms of designating products for local procurement. We're extremely slow, and we need to finalize and simplify the process for designation of products. So if we say that diesel engine is South Africa, is manufactured in South Africa, what percentage of content do we talk about in terms of? So I've raised two examples of how we need to address the issue of local procurement, and I've deliberately left out government, because government has a commitment in terms of local procurement that we have, and there's a range of issues in terms of government. There's the issue of 50% set aside in terms of local procurement, the issue of small businesses that government has committed to. And in this instance, we wanted to be able to say to, unlike other job summits that the Honorable Madisha has raised in the last meeting, unlike other job summits, what are the issues that we commit business to? What are the issues that we commit labor to and civil society in terms of local procurement that we address? Instead of government coming to the table, government needs to create the enabling environment for the economy to grow. That's the bottom line. The economy grows when business comes to the table, when labor comes to the table in relationship to that. So there are a number of commitments that we've had in terms of local procurement. I've raised specifically the example of the banking industry. There's the hotel industry. The linen that you have on the bed that you sleep, the beds that you sleep on, the furniture in the hotel industry. There's a host of commitments around all of these in relationship to how we enhance local procurement. But there's a further element to this, Chair, that I wanted to address. So there's a number of companies that are operating both in SADC but across the world. The other day I walked in the street in Sri Lanka, as an example. And the first shop that they take me to is a spa. A South African spa in Sri Lanka, name in Sri Lanka. How do we make sure that, as an example, that I've raised in a spa in Sri Lanka, what are the products that spa sells in Sri Lanka that are South African manufactured? So it's not only just about local procurement, it's about how the products are South African in terms of South African companies that operate within the outside of our borders. How do they advertise aggressively and sell aggressively South African products that are produced within South Africa so that we grow not only local demand, but the demand for products outside of South Africa so that we grow the employment and the manufacturing capacity within South Africa in terms of those categories that I've raised. So it's not only just an issue of local procurement, but aggressively promoting the product of South Africa outside of South Africa in relationship to that. And here's the point that I've raised. Export drivers prioritize manufactured and processed goods in South from South Africa, so that we grow the manufacturing capacity within South Africa. That we have. So the other thing is impediment to expanding exports. So SAS came with a raft of proposals and commitments that they've made in relationship to imports and exports at our ports in our borders. So for example, if you look at the townships that we have currently, the spaza shops that we have in our township, more often than not are not South African owned. They're either owned, and this is not xenophobia, this is the reality that I have. You go to my rabat stuff, for those of us that say Victoria, for example, you can actually go to the Bellville station, at the back of the Bellville station here in Cape Town, and you would look at the stores that are there and what they sell in there. So SARS came with a raft of proposals and commitments in terms of addressing that reality, in terms of do they pay tax, are they registered, are the stuff that they're selling, are they genuine, and or are they not knockoffs in terms of it? Yesterday I walked through the airport and I saw a number of ladies with Louis Vuitton bags. and when we do that, when we buy these things from these stores, and I'm just using this as an example, what we're actually doing is we're killing our own industry, we're killing the capacity of our economy to grow and grow, because we buy these cheap Hong Kong, even if we buy them in China, as an example, because it impacts on our ability to create employment in the country. So SAS are also, one is in terms of designation, what are the things that we do? Two, are they paying tax? Are we controlling those imports that come into the country? What is the control mechanism that we put in place in order, whether it's only at the port of entry, whether it's a port of sale, because they come through different streams and different venues in terms of this. How do we deal with it? SARS also came with a raft of commitments in terms of illicit capital flow. So if money gets out of the country, in terms of how do we deal with those realities in terms of illicit capital flow? That's a one area of illicit capital flow. There are other areas in terms of the sale of contraband in the country, the sale of cigarettes, counterfeit cigarettes in the country. And that's a range of things that they, in order to address the issue of job creation in the country. So the not only about real world growth. We didn't want to go to the number issues, madam. We didn't want to say the economy will, by 2010 we will create 10,000 jobs, as an example. And at the end of the 2020, we fall flat on our faces in terms of our inability to account on the 20,000 jobs that we promised in the outset. What we wanted to do is to create the enabling environment for the economy to grow in terms of. One of the things that we do is we sit, we have countries that are now.
Just be aware that you don't have the whole day.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, for reading me in, because I wanted to talk to the whole job summit agreement that we have, because I think it's important that as a committee we deal with these realities. But we also have to be able to interact with those countries on our borders, the SADC community, the whole of Africa. How do we progressively and very aggressively influence export and, exports to these countries for South African products in this this one. So one of the things that we said is that if we talk about SMMEs in terms of the job summit agreement, we have to be distinct in relationship to how do we address SMMEs in this country. It can't be just an open SMME. We need to focus it, and we need to focus it on the township economy that we have. But the World Bank has indicated that by 2020, 9% of the jobs that will be created will be in the SMME sector. 90% of the jobs in South Africa will be sustained by the SME. How do we and cooperatives? How do we focus our attention so that the supply chain that we have flows from the township economy right through the, so it's an issue about standardization, it's an issue about designation in terms of township economy. If that welder in the township, how do we make sure that welder gets a job from as an example, from the bank, so that we don't exclude them from the supply chain, but include them aggressively in relationship, and that is where we will go. We will firstly grow the township economy, and we will then create jobs in terms of. In this instance, for example, the banking industry has put aside 100 billion rand as a result of the job summit in order to finance and grow the black small business economy. 100 billion rand over the next 5 years, a specific for that industry that we have. So there's that commitment that we have, and we will have to monitor these things. We also have the proposal that government will work with the financial sector to talk about the issue of financing. Financing the small business at preferential rates and extended repayment. So we have issues around. Extending the ability for medium and small enterprises to access finance in relationship to the next factory. We've identified a number of sectors, whether it's the tourism sector, whether it's the clothing sector, whether it's the automotive sector, whether it is the agricultural sector, in terms of how do we focus our approach. And again, you will see that all of these, there's a linkage between the job summit, between the 9-point plan, the MTF and the investment summit, as well as the stimulus package that we have. that we want to create this linkage between all these initiatives in terms of job creation, that we don't have go helter-skelter and just identify new areas of intervention, but a linkage should be there in relationship to this. So we talk about patient industrial finance, we talk about better price financing in terms of it, we talk about distressed firm financing that we have. How do we deal with my firm that has a problem with financing and distressed in relationship to it? How do we provide financing for their distressed financing? What are the mechanisms that we put in place in order to deal with distressed financing in terms of it? So I've spoken about all of these issues. The further issue that I wanted to talk is how do we create both upstream and downstream economies and support those upstream and downstream economies in terms of our industrial capabilities, whether it's in metal and machinery value chain, whether it is in relationship to the retail clothing, textile, whether it's footwear, mask, pants, and whether it's in relationship to sound water resource management, for example. South Africa sits with a situation where we have a number of areas in North Africa where we either affected by drought or the ability, South Africa does not have a sustainable water resource. There was some report that said that by 2030, South Africa will have a serious water shortage crisis. The city of Cape Town, for example, is a prime example. It's not only the city of Cape Town, but there's other areas in the country that deals with this reality. How do we ensure that we have a mechanism in place that seeks to address the issue of water resource management in South Africa? And we are identifying a number of jobs that could be created in relationship to this. We throw about 110 million tons of waste every year. 110 million tons of waste every year we throw away. How do we use that waste in order to sustain our economy? Can we use that waste not only in relationship to recycling of this waste, but in terms of providing energy sources in terms of, and there's a host of proposals in relationship to waste management. The issue of slag in the mining industry as an example. How do we utilize that to create an energy source that is sustainable in the country? So it's not only just an issue about waste management as a result of the number of jobs that we can create in terms of, but utilizing that to create opportunities for jobs, opportunities for entrepreneurial interventions, etc. Then there's the issue of just transition that we have. We know that global warming is a reality that we have. It's a reality that we see in the weather pattern that we're currently experiencing. It's a reality that we see in relationship to the drought situation in South Africa. And the effects of this global warming is going to be felt by the marginalized, the vulnerable workers in the country. How do we ensure that as we manage and we transition through this global warming, this global warming process, transition economy so that we have sustainable economies. This is beyond the fourth industrial revolution. This is the impact of global change on the jobs that we have in the country. And that's an area of work that we've done as well. The second area that we addressed is the issue of SMME intervention. And I've raised a number of issues around SMME interventions in the country. We spoke about the 6% set aside, we spoke, and the commitment by the government to pay small enterprises within 30 days. This commitment we want to extend beyond the government, but also to the private sector. And there's a number of private sector initiatives that have agreed to the 30% payment period. The hotel industry is a prime example. Again, that said, we commit that we will pay our small service providers within 30 days. And there's a whole. I'm just using the hotel industry as an example. Then there is an agreement in relationship to township and informal settlements. There is a 1.5 billion that government has set aside for smallholder support fund and a 1.5 billion for the township enterprise fund. Again, to prioritize township, the township economy that we have. And how do we include them in the value chain, the global value chain that we have in the country? So, for example, if there is a CMT cut, make it term in the clothing industry initiative in Mitchell Springs, which there are a number of CMT initiatives in Mitchell Springs. How do we include them in the global value chain, for example, of H&M, Mr. Price, as an example? How do we maximize their input in terms of these global value chains, so that we don't just pump money into the CMT industry, for example, in Mitchell Springs, but how do we actively include it in the global value chains of all of these industries? So the supply chain of the work. The job summit is a critical element that we need to look at. One of the things that we've indicated, for example, is more often than not what industry says is that we don't have the institutions that we have, the TVET colleges, the universities that we have, do not supply the kind of skills that we require. So we say to industry, what is it that you can do in order to address that gap? Give us a commitment by yourself, industry, business, to say, if we address the issues of supply chain, supply side demand, how do you address it? So one of the commitments deals with the issue of curriculum development, for example. So if we go to TVET colleges, if we go to universities, for example, and we look at the curricula that is developed in relationship to what they provide, what is it that you can put on the table, not only as a demand from business, but as a constructive input into the process in terms of changing the product that is derived from TVET colleges and universities in relationship to that? Chair, almost done. I know you are concerned about, but I think it's important that you look at the supply chain. And there's a host of things. That's the one area of commitment that we have. The second area of commitment that we have is that when I go out as a youth to find work, more often than not, I don't have the resources to go and find work. What is it that you put in place for me in order to develop my CV, but also to bring to the place of interview that we have? And these are things that we don't have a commitment as yet in terms of the job summit process, but something that we need to that we currently discussing in terms of how do you enable me as a job seeker to go find a job and be placed in a job that I have in terms of that. So there's a host of commitments in relationship to Harambe, the Yes employment project that we have, in order to address these issues, and it's directed approaches in terms of, so for example, if they're working for water in TVET colleges, for example, what is the commitment that we put in place in terms of working for water as an example? And I spoke, for example, on the last slide on education and skills. Social partners agree. No. Public and private funding will be directed to funding work readiness interventions that find the shortest and simplest way to fill the gap for young people and help the transition to work opportunities. A mechanism to support young work seekers. So, for example, we have these bus routes in the major cities. The Avaya, Ariane, the high city sector. Why should I, as a work seeker, having had these opportunities, possibilities, pay if I go for an interview, if I go for a job, pay for these services that in place. We're trying to get the municipalities and the metro in line, and they have a commitment already in terms of this, but it's just a mechanism of allowing this to happen. So that if I go for a job as a youth in Cape Town, I can get onto the MyCity, I should get onto the bus, the MyCity buses, free of charge in order to be able to go and go for that interview. The mechanism to work this out is something that we will have to go through. Inclusive growth intervention. Here's an area which I must say that the framework agreement is very scant on, and we still need to do a lot of work in relation to the inclusive growth and intervention. But there's a few things that I think the issue of equity in some piece, we need to deepen that, not only in terms of employment but in terms of ownership. And there's some discussion that we can't have next to deepen the transformation and engagement of workers. So we're talking about worker directors that company. We're talking about all of these issues that we talk to in terms of it. Disclosure on executive pay ratios and how we develop the modalities. Government, the SMS members, we've committed SMS members in without their knowledge, obviously. Those are DGs, DDGs, etc. For being able to have a lifetime audit if it is necessary. To do that. Because it's a perception around corruption, it's a perception around and the reality of the lifestyles of some of these individuals that we need to address. The issue of SAIAS in terms of our legislation, it's not just going to happen. We have to change the issue of how we deal with SAIAS in relationship to our legislation. It's just not going to have to be a tick box exercise that we're doing in terms of. So it addresses not only the issue of inclusive growth, but it's also talks to the issue of policy certainty that we have. Public and social intervention primarily talks to the commitment of government in terms of EPWP, social audit framework, talk to the issue about the employment tax incentive. There's a commitment that the employment tax incentive, which was only in place for 5 years, to extend it for another 10 years with the review after 5 years. In terms of, there's clear evidence that the employment tax incentive is working. There's clear evidence. Research has indicated how do we improve and expand the employment tax incentive to be able to deal with it. The issue about training layoff scheme that when company X applies for assistance, it takes an inordinate amount for the training layoff scheme to kick in, because you have to first identify whether this person is compliant with UIF contribution, has contributed compensation. But by that time that you've done all of the exercises, company extras closed down. How do we simplify? We still need to go through the governance process, but how do we simplify the process of the training layoffs? I mean, there's a commitment in terms of the framework agreement in terms of how we deal with, for example, placing it in the ambit of the CTMA. So that you don't have to run to jump through all of these hoops. You still need, there are some moves that you need to that you comply with. But how do you deal with that in terms of so there's agreement, for example, that training layer scheme will be located within under the auspices of the CTMA. See how it's implemented in relation to that. So that we simplify the process of training layoff scheme. I've spoken about the financial disclosure for people in terms of the SMS, so that we extend that beyond SMS members. Currently, SMS members are only SMS members that are required to do what's the word that I'm going to use now? Exactly. So that even those guys in supply chain must be able to be subjected to this. So, Chair, in conclusion, we anticipate that the job summit will create about 275,000 jobs, direct jobs a year. Now, the number may sound small, and yes, it is small. But on average, over the last 5 years, all of the economic interventions that we've had in the country created about 300,000 jobs, my apologies. 300,000, the economy without the intervention. So if you add the 300,000 jobs about on average about that the economy is created, plus about 275,000 jobs, only on the intervention of the job summit, plus the 292 billion rand investment possibilities and the job creation possibilities of the investment summit. In addition to that, the stimulus package that has been created, there's a possibility that these jobs that we created, these interventions that we put in place, not only create the number of jobs over the next couple of years, but also provide a catalytic intervention for the ability of the economy to grow. So that if we create jobs, a housing project, it would be a catalytic intervention, so that there's a host of spin-offs in relationship to the number of jobs that we've created. So 275,000 jobs for the intervention that we've placed in terms of the presidential job summit might sound limited, small number of jobs. But if you look at what the economy has created over the last 4 years of average, 300,000 jobs, 275,000 jobs is not a small intervention, we believe. So we have not finalized the discussion today, actually. This is the last slide, and I promise you this is the last slide. We have not finalized the discussion. There are broader discussions that we need to have. There are discussions around macroeconomic issues. Whether we are, as a country, have the appropriate macroeconomic outlook that we have. So that's the one area. There are the areas of discussion that we've agreed on that we will touch on post the job summit, because this was only phase one that we have. The second thing that we need to deal with, there are issues that we discussed at NEDLAC which we couldn't finalize for the job summit. We will have to finalize that job summit. But the third area that is important, which is different to other job summits, is that we need to put in place a monitoring mechanism that will see whether the commitment that you have made as business, the commitment that you have made as labor. Labor, for example, indicated that they will build a factory in the eastern, a clothing factory in the eastern state. Creating a hunt. Now again, the numbers sound limited in relationship to the size of the problem that we have. About 100 people, creating employment for 100 people, a commitment by labor, which has never happened in terms of the job summit, that they will establish a factory, a clothing factory within the eastern state, something which has never happened in this industry. So there's a host of opportunities that we have. All of these, the monitoring mechanism will be institutionalized in NEDLAC, and we will have to find money through the fiscus to fund this monitoring mechanism, because they've got to go to the Eastern Cape to find out whether this factory has been established. It has got to go to the manufacturing industry, the automotive industry, to see whether the commitments that have been made. It's got to go to the tourism industry, the hotel industry, in terms of the commitment to local procurement. In terms of that, in broad, is the outcome of the job summit. There is a framework agreement that we have that includes all of the commitments. Underlying this presentation is a framework agreement with all of the issues, and I didn't want to talk through those issues in detail. Otherwise, we could sit here for another 2 months in relation to the
that's a good escape route. thanks for some reasonable passion to the subject at hand now. Honorable members, the intention we are having is not to amend the agreement, and it is not to review the agreement. The intention is for us to understand what is entailed in the document, so that then we are able, as we engage the relevant partners and the relevant sectors, and then and test their own commitment to what they've committed to do. So in other ways, is that at the moment, then one would open up for us to get clarified more wherever there is no clarity. It may not assist us to review a particular clause or sentence and say, no, they have not thought properly, because we can't change the document. It's to understand the content now and understand what they are committed to and make sure that we understand fully so that we are able to hold them to what they have agreed upon. But during your time, you have never committed to build a factory. This time around, the labor commits to build a factory and employ 100 people.
It is not true.
Let's give them time.
I can tell you.
Yes. Let me open now for points of clarity, questions of clarity, and then if there is anything that should be more clarified. America, you can shoot. We'll just go in a line.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very pleasing to the thank you, Mr. Speaker, for the presentation. Your passion is palpable. Feel the passion in your presentation. Is that you have this singular belief that although this is not the final destination, but certainly it's a step towards creating more jobs. Now, in your presentation there are quite a number of matters that you have raised, and I'm particularly pleased to hear that the labor movement is going to establish their own factory, and I'd like to see that come to fruition, and whether they will be able to offer the employees the kind of conditions of service that they often demand from other employers. My take on this, and although there are certain things that was not touched on in your presentation or in terms of initiatives that would support job creation, my belief and what as part of your opening address is that we need to buy local, we need to buy proud in South Africa, and if we do that, we will stimulate internal demand, and that will create jobs, etc. Now, I have a different view of that, although that's important, and one economist, Professor Rousseau from University of Witwatersrand, Jannie Rousseau, saying that if the South African government simply just buying cars manufactured in South Africa, it will provide an enormous economic impetus to the economy, and that will create jobs. Be it as it may, I am of the view that we must have an external, although internally it's important, we also need to have an externally global approach in terms of how we conduct our business and develop our strategies. It is my belief that one of the fundamental reasons why, and it is not the only reason why we are unable to create jobs, it's many of the factors that you have identified, but it is often, perhaps the lack of competitiveness of our industries. And they are severely sort of restricted in terms of statutory obligations that they have to comply with. We're going to implement the national minimum wage that will have a direct impact on certain industries, and I'll come back to that. Secondly, we have interest rates that impact upon the competitiveness of our businesses. We have very high interest rates, and that brings about also administrative pricing that places serious cost burdens on our businesses. We have change controls, or lack thereof, so to speak, and it's something that this particular committee, of course, cannot address, but it is something that we need to talk to. We have economies of scale that impact upon the competitiveness of our industries. We have, what you have correctly pointed out, policy uncertainties, and that results in restrictive investment within our businesses. So, what we need to look at is that what we as government can do to a large extent to assist particularly those small, medium, micro enterprises to become more competitive, precisely because they are the ones who don't have the benefits of economies of scale and access to markets, etc., that they don't grow, and we need to have a particular policy in relation to those SMEs that operate in the townships, because our SMEs in the townships are hamstrung by a lot of restrictive measures and they don't grow out of their backyards. They don't go out of the township because they don't get the support. So, what this job summit did not address, I didn't get it, is innovation, research and development, to what extent, are we going to place a focus on innovation and how can we, because 27.7% is that it is the highest unemployment rate of all the countries in the world, and it has been like that for years. So there are a number of countries, countries who are at war with itself and with others, they don't have the high unemployment rate. Of course, war creates jobs, of course. What have they done correctly? We often ask the West and Euro worship, the socialists, etc. But if you look at unemployment rate within the West is very low. Have we comparatively looked at what successful countries are doing in terms of job creation, and what we are doing? And how we could possibly learn from what they're doing. And then lastly, Mr. Chair, Mr. Sifley spoke about bringing those township industries into the global value chain and how I don't expect you to give all the answers to that. And you specifically made reference to the CMTs. Now, there are CMTs who operate in the towns, who operate very informally, but they are formalized, more sophisticated CMTs like those clothing factories in Newcastle. They are basically a bigger form of CMTs. Now, apart from those CMTs, I'm specifically referring to those in the township where I come from, that I'm familiar with. Those CMTs are largely unformalized. They're not formalized. They operate on very tight margins, they often do not comply with labor legislation. So often they don't know about labor legislation, let alone complying. And it is like, you know, they dream it because they want to put bread on the table. I mean, it is not a business structure that will enrich them. Now, these CMTs, you know, how are we going to bring them into the global value chain? Because if we do that, then they will be hamstrung by legislation, compliance matters, and it will completely make them uncompetitive. So that, so my take, Mr. Chair, in conclusion, is that if we want jobs to be created, we need to, all those initiatives that were discussed at the Job Summit were contributing initiatives. They will, if, you know, if it comes to fruition, they will add to job creation, certainly. But we must not become an insular sort of economy where we simply just look at ourselves. We need to have a global sort of approach and vision towards how we do business and how we can, as government, create an environment that will assist our companies to become more competitive so that they could sell their products worldwide, because we have a very small market. And if you have a greater market to sell your products, invariably that will lead to certain job creations. And in conclusion, and I agree that many job seekers have sort of restrictions in terms of you don't have money, you live in a township, you parents don't work, you know, they don't have money for you to go look for a job. And we need to provide our youth with a kind of assistance so that they could possibly, you know, get to the centers where, you know, opportunities are. And I'm happy to say that the city of Cape Town, and my city in particular, have, you know, an initiative that will enable unemployed youth to use my city jobs for free in the pursuit of looking for a job opportunity. The exact detail of it, I'm not so sure because I'm not there, but a council resolution was taken many months ago, earlier this year, to make that reality within the new financial year, which was beginning on the 1st of July. And as far as the 275,000 jobs are concerned, it's a low target. Now, I agree, it is an attainable target. It is nowhere near enough to absorb the new entrants into the job market, and therefore economic growth is of absolute importance to enable us to create the necessary jobs that our economy and our youth and our people require. And incidentally, I mean, in terms of the quarterly labor force survey, 188,000 jobs were created the past financial year, and of that, majority were created in the Western Cape. And that's not enough. I mean, and we need an even distribution of job creation throughout the country, because it is pervasive throughout the country, and our people need access to opportunities. So, Mr. Chair, finally, I never got any sense from this presentation and from having read through the documentation, is that, and it is specifically applied to this committee, to have we identified, considered, is it going to be part of the agenda, whether there are any labor legislations that restrict job creation, particularly legislation, because we have a gold standard labor legislation. It's great for large businesses. They can fully comply, they have the capacity to do that. But what Mr. Seifert was saying about those CMTs and those SMMEs who don't have the infrastructure and the capital, for them it becomes sometimes very difficult. I thank you, sir.
Honorable Madisha.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair President, all members.
But you know, I imitate the example that America has given us.
Come again, please.
Don't follow the example of America. He appears to be the first to speak and speak endlessly.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, don't imitate him.
Okay. No, thank you very much. You know, I sat here, by here I'm referring to the office, Chairperson, going through this entire document. And I then drew a conclusion that, well, a lot that was supposed to be done has not been achieved. And one can actually go into those particular points one by one. If you were to allow me, I'll do that. But then permit me to indicate, Chairperson, that of course we are going to repeat very many points that we have already raised, of course, in the past in this meeting. But one, as you indicate, do not want to do that. We follow your orders. Let me indicate that, number one, I mean, we are the most important. I know others may debate who are beyond this world, that we are not, but we are the most important committee compared to all the committees of parliament here. Yeah. Why? Because we deal directly with the people of our country. If they've got to get access to health, well, be it government will say free and so on, it is not. We know. Okay? If our people have got to get access to health, to food, to proper housing, the majority, the Africans in particular, to proper burials, etc. You know, all the basics, to water, security, and sewerages. I mean, I was in the Northern Cape. I've gone to, you know, some of the, you know, African areas, and one has seen what is actually happening. Now, these people, our people, cannot get access because they are not working, they are not having the money to either purchase or get into those particular, or achieve those particular areas and facilities that are needed. I therefore say, through your chair, we need to be extremely serious and open and not say, because I come from this party, by hook or crook, I will say that we are succeeding or we are not succeeding so that I can protect myself and my party. I would say that we need to do that. We are extremely important as this committee, and we must look at the entire country and say, this is what needs to be achieved. I mean, you can talk about the Department of Finance. They are doing that, looking at, you know, at the people, the health, and all the other departments or committees. So we need to understand that. Now, as this committee, we must base our debate on the empirical evidence. Permit me again to say that. That is there in the country. Not to rise and say there is victory here. Like you are saying, 27%. And I have said in the past, no. It's beyond 40% unemployment rate. But I know many people have reason to say, no, it's 27%. Even others who have not checked properly. Just because they heard somewhere, they say 27% or less, and we are improving, and so on. But then they come back and say, the youth in our country is beyond 66%. They are not employed. And the older age, the people who are supposed to be working were not the youth and younger. We're talking about 27%. Now, if you were to calculate 27%, 66%, you combine, divide into all these things, do we come to 27% or 26%, etc.? I think these are some of the things that we need to check. And the department here needs to assist. And perhaps one would even go on to say, what is the scientific analysis that you use to check? Have you gone out maybe and said, okay, we check 2,000 people. Are you working? Are you working? Are you working? And then we draw the conclusion. These are some of the things through you, my chair, that we need to look at as a committee and as a parliament. Because at the end, you see very many people around are, you know, we see health. And I have said in the past, and I want to repeat, that it is beyond 40%. And even at that, it means 4 out of 10 people are not working, but these 6, I want to repeat, are people from beyond our borders. I want to repeat, and you know better than I do, all of you, that you go to the restaurant, I repeat my chairperson, who is working there? Who you go to the petrol station? Who is working there? And so on. And those are the people, I want to repeat, who are not even getting a salary, but getting tips. Now, these are the realities. So it means even out of these 6, more of our people are not working. You have people who are from beyond our trees who are working, from Nigeria, Zimbabwe, etc. So we're faced with a very serious problem. And I would appeal that this committee must look into and indeed deal with this a problem. Now, I further would say that it's unfortunate we were not invited to participate in the conference. Would you call it conference?
Summit.
Summit. I will say that in my own opinion, as I went through this file last night, unless proven otherwise, would say that it has not looked into, the actual industrial revolution at the moment. Because at the moment in our country, what is happening is that given the progress and so on, our people, the majority of whom have not been taken through education, people who have not achieved education are quite high. People are using the machines. Look at yourselves. You are using that. You go to the banks nowadays. People are no longer going to the tellers, etc. You go all over. Now, these are things which are there. Now, the issue of the fourth industrial revolution, have you looked into that so that you then can be able to say, let's deal with this and make sure that we improve the lives of the people of our country? I am not satisfied as I went through this document that yes, indeed, we have been able to do that properly. You have indicated, for example, that we are doing work there, we can improve there. Again, like I'm saying, one has moved around the country, Chairperson. You know that South Africa is one of the topmost countries that will produce manganese and other mineral resources. Top, we are there. But then I don't see or hear the department saying, this is what we are going to do or this is what we have resolved to do. We produce this and then we take this to China and so on. Now, they produce clothes, they produce machines, iron, etc., then send it to us. We use a lot of money to purchase those. What have you said or are proposing we've got to do to deal with that? Now, it's a lot of things, and I therefore would say, in my own opinion, that which you are putting here as the way forward is not enough. And I would then say that this is perhaps a few points that you say we need to look into, but that isn't enough at all. And I wish to repeat again here that what I have been able to see in this document is the repetition of what was done in 1998. This honorable, this poor MPIB was the head of self as well.
Order, honorable Madisha.
Yes.
Maybe you'll need a substantive motion to say it's what.
No, he was once a member of parliament. He was honorable.
Yes.
Now,
just call him the former.
Oh, the honorable
member. Then I think it will be adequate. Other than this additional adjective.
Former honorable. And yourself as well, and others. You know, when we popped out that 89 million rand, which you said I must share. So you hear, yes, from the workers. Now you have just said that that Willy Madisha has never said we should build factories and so on. We did, for your information, my dear person. Many around the Western Cape here that went on to produce clothes. One, for example, we made sure that the workers were able to become, look, they worked and they led and they produced clothing, and they were beyond 1,200 workers. And then the factory is still there. The farms around the country, about 40,000 workers. We got 89 million, we used 40 million when I left, and by the time I left, we're remaining with the 69 million. I mean, there is evidence, it is there, you can check. Now, these are some of the things that need to be checked and see how we can improve and do this thing. I therefore want to say, without wasting your time, I don't want to go to America, or honorable America, like you indicated. I think more has got to be looked into. Yes, I contested the fact that you went there alone. It's fine. But then let us sit and look into this thing properly so that there can be proper implementation. Not claim victory, but say, where are the people of our country?
That's the main reason why I'm saying that let us get to understand this document so that we hold the people that are agreeing in this document to their weight, and then and make sure that they implement what they have said. I think there is a slide number. This slide number. The key area number one, the slide that talks to key area number one, but the second slide with the top bullet that talks about social partners will embark on, just talks to the beneficiation.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's those metals, minerals, and whatever.
Yeah.
It looks like there's an intention to say, let's try and process them further before we export them, rather than the current situation. That's my understanding to it. Mentor Jogo, you are next on the line.
Thank you, Chair. One short question. One short question is, as the partners, committed to doing this and that with regard to the job summit. Were there any time frames attached to all the activities? Thank you.
Honorable Van Kaal, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. I am mostly covered by the previous speakers, so I won't repeat. Just one question to Mr. Sixfield. They stress this committee that's been established containing, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, consisting of the various stakeholders who will be responsible for driving this process. But when looking to the government sector, there's a lot of issues that needs to be dealt with internally. It's cross-cutting between the departments. Is there also a structure that has been proposed in terms of interdepartmental cooperation in terms of strengthening this agreement? For instance, if we talk about a mismatch of skills, we know there's various departments that affected through this thing. And one of the main departments is the Department of Higher Education and Training. So it would be necessary for them to, we don't want a talk shop anymore, we need action. But when we talk about action, we need time frames attached to it, and we need to see things being developed. Because when we talk about mismatch of skills, we might also talk about curriculum change. Because we know that majority of this unemployed job seekers or youth, including those coming from secondary level, even though fee-free education has been declared, you have that scenario where the youth are going to the TVET colleges, they're signing up for higher education and training, but they don't necessarily have the necessary guidance in terms of prospective jobs that will give them that surety of being employable. So there's different departments that need to play the role, including the Department of Basic Education also, in trying to drive those prospective job seekers into a certain direction. And I'm also particularly thinking in terms of choosing subjects that will be outcome-based. Because when we look at entrance into higher education and training, you will find sometimes that they don't meet the requirements that's needed for certain jobs. And it's starting from grade 10 level where they choose the subject for further education and training to be relevant. So those are the kind of interventions that we need from grassroots level to be rather proactive than reactive. Also, when we look at the statements that's been made and the calls that's been made in terms of localization, we know there's various departments that's also dealing with that issue. But do we think that we have enough measures in place to conscientize the communities at large, require them to make the right decisions, because when they go to a local shop, an ordinary shop, they assume, some of them just don't have the knowledge to go there and look for those specific garments or those specific things that they would that's been localized. So those are the kind of things, including food production and all those kinds of things, because we tend to focus on exporting, but we don't have that urgency or that loyalty as some of ordinary citizens to indeed look at localized products, locally produced products. Those are the kind of things that we have to look at. But also during the various initiatives by the different departments in terms of the Easing Bezos, in terms of focus initiatives, meeting the people, those are the kind of things that need to find expression in those engagements to conscientize the communities and to urge them. Also, you are talking about the World Bank's prospects or what they are talking about, 2020, 90% of jobs that will be from the SMMEs and cooperatives. What is the role that we are playing as this department in ensuring or assisting other sister departments to strengthen that function, because we need to prepare our people on the ground to not to see jobs as formal jobs, but to be have their own initiatives in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of cooperatives. But some of our citizens are lacking the knowledge. They want to do it, they just don't know the know-how to do it. So I would then suggest that as part of this initiative from this committee, those are the kind of initiatives that should arise from there, so that we can see the impact and we can be ready in terms of rolling out this whole thing and reaching our the targets as being set there. And even if things are being done correctly and proactively and vibrantly, we may even increase those targets as being set there. So those are the kind of things you've mentioned about different areas that can be tapped out, prospective areas that can be tapped out on in terms of, like, for instance, this waste management thing. How do we translate those kinds of things to the ordinary citizens? Because some of the people, they have that urge, they have that commitment, they want to start something, but they don't know how to start it, and if there's a need for that thing to be developed. So if we can also conscientize our citizens in terms of prospective initiatives that will be successful, things like that, it's also going to assist us. Then I want to agree, even though I don't want to delve deep into the issue of the initiatives in terms of the prospective job seekers. We need to strengthen those initiatives also, so that we can really assist those young people especially. I think for now I pause there, Jefferson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm sure it's civil. They've raised quite a good number of things that needs more, little bit of clarifications, and some are comments and all that. But from my side, and then without really talking too much, is that the agreement, whether the department, of course, is together with NEDLAC, I'm sure it's the NEDLAC context, whether we have analyzed the agreement, because what one is seeing is that the agreement seeks to recognize globalization, that we have got an open economy or a market economy, But then part of the agreement seeks to speak to elements that require protectionism and also that requires support for some sort of a communist production method to ensure that you've got targeted, you achieve targeted objectives. Because in an open economy, then you can't protect anybody. And then that's why then you've got an element that you also have indicated, and the Honorable America has spoken to, the element of competitiveness. Remember, competitiveness is about in an open ground, where the best then reaps the benefit and the worst lose out and close shop. But like as we are saying, is that where you don't have capacity in the small industries, in the township economies, where you actually also have a target or an objective that people must buy local, that means you must bring in some elements of protectionism. Then there is contradictory elements of the agreement. And then the analysis of each and every individual agreement or concept that we agree on as an intervention that we need to embark on. How is it going to be supported to be achieved under given conditions of the economy? We're speaking about the financial sector. Everybody knows that the financial sector is about making business. You're not going to win outright to negotiate the financial sector to actually give small industries or enterprises money where they cannot get anything in return for the investment. Not going to be easy. But then we are speaking about lobbying the financial sector to actually assist the small industries in the township economy or rural economies for them to be productive, because we have been told or threatened that by 2020 or 2030, I may not have heard properly, that 90% of job opportunities will be sustained by small business. But the question is, skills that you don't have, that you must still produce. Then investment or capital that is required to run those small businesses. And then you've got SARS on one side that doesn't understand the small business. They're looking at the small business as if they are looking at a conglomerate in a global market. For every one rent that small little business is making, they want their share. Now, the market where these products also have to be sold, when you speak about competition, the small business may be producing, but producing to nowhere. Because then there are in the open market there that they fine-tuned their production lines, that they are producing high quality product, more than what it is produced at Vilakazi Street. Then which means is that there is a need of some level of protectionism that is required. But then also within the economy, see if it, you have got contradictory forces. When you bring in investment from outside the country and the economy, one, of course, they'll want return on their investment, it's fine. But then they would invest in a business which it is an open market-related business. Then the possibilities that they may bring a lot of machinery which is not going to open job opportunities. I think it's just like as I've said, I think the other week, it will assist us to grow the, you know, the economy, but not to grow the number of job opportunities. Which means is that we have got an investment that is sharing job opportunities. That's what your fourth industrial revolution will do, which may end up forcing us then to come up with plans to actually mitigate by actually trying to control the impact of the fourth industrial revolution. Then I repeat the proposal that I raised last week, that there may be a need that there is a counter policy that seeks to target certain sectors or certain productions to be labor-based in order that you don't have millions and millions of people idling around at home and machines are producing in the factory for them. Because if machines are producing in the factory, whatever is made for the owner of the factory, not for those people that are in the bars and lounges, in the township, in the villages, drinking beer the whole day. Not going to produce and make money for them. It's for the owner of the factory. But then those people stay there in the rural villages and the township. Then they may be planning to illegally share with the owners of the factory and create a criminality. So which means is that while we are looking at ourselves as a country as a global player, but there are these other consequences that will arise from us being a global player. That means is that we must open our economy with the consequences of jobs being shared. And then we have to actually take care of those people, which means that you must come up with plans that seeks to say, no. Your fourth industrial revolution then cannot throw so many people out. Then we must protect these people with their jobs, that nor here, nor machines. For so many years or whatever, the transitional arrangement, that the machines may be introduced over a period of time, while we are reskilling or whatever. I think that is the issue that I just wanted to raise. The fact of the matter is that even if we are a global player, the fact of the matter is that we are a developing country. We have not fully developed. We have got challenges of skills, and and therefore, you cannot just simply open 100%. And then the two economies for this country then will remain intact with us for quite a long time. Because we have got part of South Africa that is running far ahead, and one part is lagging far behind. And all of them, they've got the similar rights. Now, the other issue which you maybe can explain more, it is the level of authority that this agreement has. The level of authority. How authoritative is this document? And what sort of recourse does the state, or maybe let me not say the state, the partners that have agreed on this document have over each other? The understanding is that all the partners have agreed that they would not shared jobs. Government, public, they've said no, no retrenchments, nothing. Business also have said so, that they'll strive to make profit without firing people or retrenching people. But then all of us, all of a sudden now from public, through SABC, already there is a non-compliance. How authoritative is this agreement? Does it provide the other partners recourses where one partner misbehaves in terms of this particular agreement? And if there is any level of authority that it has, what is the punitive measure to actually whip the partners in line when they are actually getting out of it? Yeah, you may proceed if you are ready. I just hope that I'm not confusing you a lot more.
No, Jay, can I just for the record, I have about 20 pages of questions that the members raised.
Maximum 20 minutes.
So, Jay, can I just raise the issue, and you started with the issue about what, and maybe it's an important point that I need to raise, the issue of passion around the presentation that was done. It arises from an understanding of commitment from all the social partners that sat around the table that recognizes that we have a problem in the country. And what we put on the table must be, and I'm starting to address some of the questions in generality, that all of us need to play a role in terms of addressing this problem. You would recall at some stage in our discussion there was this comment that government would retrench 30,000 workers. It was right in the papers. The social partners called the president to this, and it talks about the punitive measures and the control mechanisms and the authority of it. Call the president to Nedley to account on this statement of about the loss of 50,000 jobs. Where the president, as an example, made a commitment that this 50,000 jobs that are bandied around in the newspapers is a figment of somebody's imagination. And government will not retrench that 50,000 jobs. So that's the sort of authority that this process has in terms of where we are for this process. And I'm trying to answer the last question. They are not punitive measures. Does not say that when Honorable X does not do what he is committed to do, he will be taken to jail or whatever that. But there's an accountability matrix that we built into this job summit agreement, and we're still developing the monitoring mechanism that we've agreed to in principle in terms of how we will hold each other accountable. And this is work that is still continuing in terms of that. So I think it's an important element that we need to bring. Honorable America raised the issue about that we need to have a global approach in terms of dealing with jobs and the economy in this country. We agree with the sentiment that we cannot operate as if we are an island on our own in the economic sphere that we operate. But we need to be able to say that for this, and also address some of your concerns, this product will be designated to be made in South Africa, as an example, and so that we clear in relationship to what is the protectionist role that we play in the economy. The South African government has, to a very large extent, not played this protectionist role. That's why, for example, Honourable Madisha, you find that that people in the hospitality industry, more often than not, if you go to petrol station, more often than not, they are not South Africans. I would hazard a guess in terms of the percentage of employed people that are not South African. In terms of about 80 to 90% of the people that are employed in the hospitality industry are not South African. And therefore we need to play some protectionist role in terms of whether they are a scarce skills initiative that we need to strengthen, whether there's a host of other things that we need, and provide the kind of protection for our people that we have. However, we need to understand the reality that we are a member of a global community. And as a member of the global community, there are areas around us that will become dependent upon us again, and even to a greater extent if our protectionism goes to the extent that we exclude members of the SADC countries, as an example, to participate in our economy. We have to recognize and deal with this thing, deal with this issue. So there's a host of initiatives that government has put in place, Honorable America, that deals with the sort of restrictive nature of how we engage with the economy. We have, for example, a government put in place a one-stop service, so that if you want to establish a company as an investor in South Africa, you go to one area and you deal with all of your legislative requirements in terms of that one instance. So where we've co-opted the number of players in South Africa. So if it's about registration for UIF and compensation fund, in terms of the South Africa Department of Labour example, you go to one area. Whether it's about registration of burden, you go to one area and you do all of these things in South Africa, so that the registration of deterrents are addressed in relation to that. We spoke about the issue of policy uncertainty. I've raised one or two examples, but it cuts across a host of other issues in relationship to policy uncertainty. When we started this discussion, we said that there are no holy cows. There are no holy cows. We need to address all of the issues that we have to address. For example, the domain, and I'm being deliberately argumentative in terms of my example. Is it the domain of the Reserve Bank to establish policy about inflation targeting, or is it the domain of government? And whether the Reserve Bank is just an implementer of the policy of government? And again, please know that I've been deliberately argumentative in terms of my example. Most of areas in the world where you have seen economic growth, China, India, has not in their policy, economic and macroeconomic policy, do not have inflation targeting. Is it something that we can follow, or is it something that you have to expand the mandate of the Reserve Bank in terms of it, so that we do not prohibit our economy to grow and the ability to create employment, as an example. Again, I'm indicating as an example of no holy cows that we need to address. So the policy, you spoke about innovation and research and development. The framework agreement looks at innovation in a number of ways. One is in relationship to small businesses and to excess funding, excess training, and excess capacity building. That's one area of innovation that the framework agreement talks about. It talks about patient finance. If you Patient finance, I'm just using one example of innovation that there are other areas of innovation, product innovation that we need to deal with. And the CSIR, for example, does a lot of work, whatever it is, we are currently an example. So we need to look at how do we build a capacity in small business, because it talks about innovative ways in terms of how we build a capacity in small business in township economies to not only operate as businesses, so those kinds of skills that you require, but also how you link them into the global supply chain that you have in the country. But the example of CMT is a very, very, very good example in terms of this argument. Say that, for example, the clothing industry is a footloose industry. The textile industry is a footloose industry. It is very easy for a company to pick up their 600, 700, 800 machines and move them to an area where Lesotho across the border, as an example. It's very easy to do that if you are not satisfied with the conditions in the country. And we need to be able to, and there's this dynamic tension that we have to guard against in terms of, do we allow for the abuse of our workers in an industry, for example, the low-paid workers that we have, the social security benefits that they may have impacted on in terms of the CMT industry, as opposed to having an industry where we dynamically include them within the global supply chain. How do we get Mr. Price as a major player in the retail industry, in clothing industry in South Africa, whether we like it or not, to be able to purchase locally, or a large portion of that purchase locally? We probably can't bind them, so there's a degree of protectionism that we need to play a check, that you spoke about in one of your questions that you had, so that we don't have a socialist approach to doing business, but have an approach that dynamically includes these small enterprises, these startup enterprises, into the global supply chain that we have. And then it talks to township economies that we have. The reality of the matter is, and it's a global standard, it's not a South African standard. Small businesses, micro enterprises, medium enterprises are the drivers of employment across the world. It's not only in South Africa. This notion that you have this huge conglomerate that are responsible for employment is absolutely an apparition, if you will. Small businesses, medium enterprises, and micro enterprises grow employment. Whether it's in relationship to entrepreneurial approaches, whether it's in relationship to employment proper. What are the factors that impact labor policy that impact on employment? Research done by the World Bank, not by South Africa, but by the World Bank, has indicated that our fundamentals are, our labor policy fundamentals are sound. Our labor, the fundamentals which underpin our labor policy are sound. Therefore, in order to be able to say that we are a world-class labor policy is premised on the understanding that, so what is wrong with our labor policy? The ability to hire and fire? The previous Minister of Labor, Muslim Lagana, always said, but you can't be hiring and firing already. What is the problem with that? Do you want to have a situation where you can just fire without any consequence? Because that's the fundamental that we need to deal with. Levels of unemployment, Honorable Madisha, you spoke about, whether we have a proper understanding of levels of unemployment. Now, whether you use a broad definition of unemployment or the narrow definition of unemployment, it's irrelevant. We have a problem. We have a serious problem of unemployment in the 27.7%. In terms of the narrow definition, only is huge by any standard, if you will. And you have to address that reality in terms of that. Now, whether you use a broader, extended definition of unemployment, you may come to a higher number, and you will come to a higher number in terms of it. Because what it does, it talks to those work seekers that are now actually discouraged work seekers. How do you include them into the debate? That's where the debate becomes important. How do you include them into this debate, this notion of employment, these discouraged work seekers? What are the mechanisms that you put in place in order to address that reality? The reality of the matter is 27.7%, 40%. The numbers in any standard, whether it's you're a developing country or an underdeveloped country or a developed country, are staggering by any stretch of the imagination. And that's the basis why I say the numbers become irrelevant. What is irrelevant is that we have a massive problem. Why is that irrelevant? And we need to get people into employment. We need to get people into entrepreneurship possibilities as well. You spoke about the issue of labor migration, Honorable Madisha. We are currently in the process of developing a labor migration regime that seeks to address this notion that you raise in relationship to the people that we find in areas of employment where our people could be employed. But you go to for example, to the asparagus farm in Bethlehem, as an example. And the farmers say that we go around in South Africa finding employees for the asparagus farms. South African workers don't want to work on these farms. So where do they get the people that they go across the border, Lesotho, and they find employment in terms of? That's a problem that we need to address. Is it an issue of whether our people are lazy that we find, which want to contest? Because if you look at the people standing on the street corners trying to sell something, trying to make a living for themselves, it actually counter argues the fact that our people are lazy. They are willing to stand there in the sun doing the thing. It's just an opportunity that they don't have in order to grow their businesses. And this is the one area that we need to look at in terms of the makeup of the unemployed honorable Madisha is an important issue. And there I agree with you that we need to have a clear understanding of the makeup of the unemployed. Apart from just this racial dimension of unemployed that we have, which is a reality that we need to deal with, our people are not being employed. Our people are on the street.
Address Madisha through me, otherwise Madisha will
respond. Honorable Chairperson.
And once he responds to you, I can't stop him.
So we're developing this labor migration policy, and we've made a commitment at the previous portfolio committee chair that we will submit this labor migration policy to the commission. So the policy, the framework agreement that underpins this notion of the fourth industrial revolution, which is included in each and every one of the discussions. That's why we say, for example, and when we go beyond the fourth industrial revolution, we even talk to the issue of just transition, the global warming, in terms of the. So we've extended this debate not only to talk to fourth industrial revolution, but we spoke to the issue of just transition in terms of the impact of global warming and the impact that the global warming will have on jobs going forward. We have to understand that completely. Are there time frames, Honorable Chairperson, that we have in terms of the activities? There are time frames. You will understand that we've indicated the notion that we are busy with a monitoring mechanism which will hold each one accountable to all of the social partners accountable in terms of not only their commitment but the time frame that we have in terms of delivering this commitment. as an example of sending letters schemes, there's an understanding that this will have been done within a month after the finalization of the agreement, framework agreement. Already now, my apologies, already now Labour is saying to us, you committed to a month, a 2 month period in a number of ways. Where are you in terms of the agreement, in terms of the standing layoff scheme? Honourable Van Schaik says, the majority of the economic stimulus measures that we have understanding that small, we need to include our people, we need to include the township economy in terms of these four opportunities that may be identified. And it is important that the framework agreement, that I point out, that the framework agreement acknowledges this reality, acknowledges the reality that we need to include our people, expand our economic landscape, if you will, to include our people in terms of... And therefore it talks about support, therefore it talks about extending finance, therefore it talks about the capacity building for small business initiatives in this instance. Whether we focus on localization, we think it's an important area of focus. This framework agreement, Chair, will have to be read against all of the, and I'm starting to address the questions that you've read, will have to be read in conjunction with all the other initiatives of government, because when we started this debate, we said we can't reinvent the wheel. Government has a number of initiatives already in place in order to deal with the realities of our country. Therefore, as I started with my presentation, I said that we need to look at the 9-point plan initiatives. Where are they? We need to look at the MTF deliverables in terms of growing the economy. We need to look at infrastructure development. We need to look at the stimulus package. We need to look at the investment, some of that we have, and read all of these in conjunction with each other, so that we have a broader picture in terms of what South Africa does in order to address the fault lines within the economy, the fault lines with our ability to be able to grow employment, and deal with those fault lines in totality. Are we going to a communist production mechanism where we identify certain areas that we will keep for ourselves, and the other that we will farm out in terms of our global markets approach. We will not be the only economy that does that. If you look at, for example, what America has done over the last couple of years in terms of the automotive industry, where they've actually called back, a clawed back, if you will, a number of jobs in the automotive industry that were farmed out to other countries in terms of their global approach. And unfortunately, we're at the turning point in our economy where we have to understand what is it that we can produce internally, what do we have to protect in order to protect our economy at an internal level. And we have to have some degree of protectionism. We've got to talk whether it's an issue of employment that Honourable Madisha has raised, Honourable Chair, through you, or whether it's in relationship to our productionist methods that we use. And we've got to look at it in that context. We will have to say, so there is this notion of designation that is already there. What do we designate as local procurement? What is it that we designate for local production? It's not a new thing, but EFCO already has it. So how do we strengthen that in order to protect South African economy and protect employment creation within the country. And there's some commitment about designation and the speed at which we designate some of these products in the country. Skills that we don't have in relationship to the post-industrial revolution, but also our ability, there's a clear understanding change that our education system does not deliver what the economy in the post-industrial revolution required. There's an understanding. And you can't only start at tertiary level or at secondary level. You actually got to start at the primary education level. So it's got to be a rethink of how we structure our education in the country. India, for example, when they had a discussion around the fourth industrial revolution, they changed their curriculum so that it becomes compulsory for primary school kids, children, to learn coding. That's why you see in Silicon Valley today, the majority of people employed in Silicon Valley are not Americans, are Indians, from India. Because Indians understood this reality already then, and we need to be able to take those kinds of steps in terms of our primary education changes, our secondary education change curriculum that deals with this reality. However, we sit with a legacy problem in South Africa. We sit with a legacy problem that says when you want to apply for a job, more often than not the requirement is a matric certificate. At the very least, while in fact the job that you are required to do doesn't even need a matric certificate.
You are on your last 3 minutes.
I'm on my last page as well. The majority of jobs that you are required to do doesn't even require a matric certificate. In fact, if you listen to Mr. Muratova, he actually said at some point that the majority of jobs where you require a matric certificate nowadays is that you can have a sit-by-nearly experience. A sit-by-nearly experience is where I come to your employment, you show me the job, 10 minutes, within 10 minutes I'm able to do the job. Your matric certificate. So we need to have exit points throughout the education system to allow for that. And have an agreement by business that we need to look at our requirements in terms of the job that you do. However, there's a reality that we also need to engage with, that the skills that you talk about that we don't have, we need to build those skills. And we need to have the commitment by business that says, if I require X amount of skills, what is the curriculum that I put forward in order for you to be able to supply those kinds of skills out of your Stephen College and out of your tertiary education. So that's a commitment made in terms of this framework agreement that talks to that reality. Business agreed that they will assist Stephen College, they will assist higher education institutions. So this is what we need, this is the curriculum that we require in order to do this. So I've dealt with the issue of the kind of authority and the punitive measures that we put in place, Chair. Can I just, in conclusion, indicate, Chair, this discussion is not finished. This is the first part of the discussion, the first phase of the discussion that we have. There are further phases that we need to deal with. You will recall that the President indicated that he wants this job summit every second year. To one, assess what we have done, but two, also to identify areas of problem that we need to address in the next phase of this process. Chair, I think I will stop there.
Okay. No, thanks very much. And I think it's as you move back home, the fact of the matter is that the key areas there, and both internally on the key area 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, I think it worth to be analyzed in terms of risk levels to each other. The key area number one, what sort of risk do they have to key area number two, number three, number four? How contradictory are they in terms of practical application? Practical application. If you could analyze that, and then also, like as one is saying, is that we do have two economies in the country. There is no confusion about that. And then which of the agreements within the key area that applies to the rural economy, which applies to, we sometimes call it the formal economy, whatever is called formal, and then now it is informal. Those things that we have taken, some of them apply to one economy, don't apply to the other one. Then when you apply on the other one, then you must go and defend or block the negative effects on the other one. That no, it must not go there. You see, some sort of an analysis needs to be made of those risk levels, so that then you are proactively coming up with a mechanism to mitigate any unintended negative consequences. You may have a policy or agreed position that all the social partners are agreeing, but you find that it is actually killing one sector of the economy while it is seeking to boost the other sector of the economy. Then it is important that those that are behind this particular agreement are fully aware, so that they are not caught with their pants down, if ever a pants will go down, you see. And then the other issue that one wanted to raise is, we should just ponder this particular matter simply. The authority of the document cannot be on a gentleman's agreement. It can't just rely on a gentleman's agreement only. Because the social partners, they create dependencies. If you've got a production line or a value chain that has got dependencies, if one dependent is not doing his or her job, then the chain is broken. It's broken. And with this one, it's not the same as the 9-point plan of government or what, or the stimulus package, because that is purely government, and if something doesn't happen, you can hold government to some sort of an inquiry. But this one, then there are other partners that are not part of government. They are outside. There is very little you can do about them if they just decide. They just decide not to participate. And if they just simply say, no, government, we thought you were going to do 1, 2, 3, but then it looks like, no, you are not putting a lot of money in infrastructure, therefore you can't expect us to perform on our commitment, then everything falls flat. For some other reason is that if it is possible to consider to have some sort of a mechanism that forces each other to comply, for certainty to be there on the value chain. For certainty to be there on value chain. Because if the value chain is not certain, you can't plan. Thank you very much. I think it's Bonyaka Buatis. Bonyaka Noyem Samnoa. As long as I'm not a woman.
Thank you, Chairperson, for indulging me. I just wanted to, and I know that some of the things could be a case of interpretation, but I feel strongly enough just to put those on the table. I think that you'll recall that you and I bumped into each other when we were at the job summit at Gallagher Estate, and you raised an interesting question. What is new? What is this thing? What does this whole thing have in store for us as a country? It's going to take us anywhere. And Chairperson, I do want to say that, in my view, the whole issue of the job summit and the framework agreement is not a silver bullet that is going to suddenly solve all our woes around unemployment, inequality, and so on. And if we look at it in isolation, it can't even work. So it's not a panacea that is going to solve all of our problems, but it is indeed something that is meant to complement the whole approach that we have. And Chair, there was an issue around the fourth industrial revolution and how significant that is around what leaders are trying to do. And Chair, you keep on mentioning something that I feel we should really take advantage of and influence the area around the issue of the fourth industrial revolution and its consequences, so that we come up with the other policy position or something of that sort, so that at the end of the day we become role players and initiators of this debate. So I just wanted to say it's an interesting dynamic that we really need to look at.
Okay.
Yeah.
It just simply becomes important who wakes up in Department of Labor and worry about the fourth industrial revolution.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who wakes up in the morning and then only worry about the fourth industrial revolution. If we are to comply and we are to be on par with it and not to be found wanting, somebody must champion it. It's just like the affirmative action transformation. When transformation came in, then people were told, if you don't actually become proactive in transformation, transformation will force itself on your firm, and you will cry. So the fourth industrial revolution as well is that if you want to champion it and to be in control of it, then you must be on par with it. If you lag behind, it imposes itself. Then you will be found wanting. Let me not talk too much about that. Thanks for that particular input. And we hope that, like as I've said, the key is that the social partners must find a way of creating authority of these particular documents, so that you don't have one partner committing 100% to the document and the other partners are not doing the same. Then they'll be misusing somebody else's effort. They need to have an understanding that they are equally committed. And when the other one plans on it, must reasonably expect the others to play their part. Honorable members, can I just simply, just before I go to the other reports which we are trying to introduce, just simply to take us through the set of minutes of the 31st. The minutes of the 31st. Can you just access the minutes of the 31st?
I'm allowed to go.
Come again?
I'm allowed to go.
No. No, I thought that you have written your day off, the whole day to be here. You're not going, because anything that you are doing here is about Department of Labor. Honourable members, the first page of the minutes, even though that mine doesn't, it's not page numbered. I'm sure it's the somebody's printer ran out of ink. The first page, that has got names only. Are we happy about it?
Yes.
Then the following page, that has got opening remarks, then 2.2, 2.1, and 2.2 at the bottom. Is there anything to be changed, corrected there? Nothing, Mr. Madish. The third page. Mendonga, the third page, where you've got 3 and 3.1.
Nothing.
No problem. And then the fourth page, that deals with paragraph 3.2 and 4. Pascal Vic, are you happy?
Yes.
And then the fifth page that deals with closing and BL Mashile. None? Honorable Pascal Vic?
I move for adoption of the ministry.
There is a move for the adoption. Anybody who second, Honorable Dadema Disha, second. Dadema Disha is seconding the adoption of the minutes.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I think it's I've just made us to approve these minutes because. There is one member or two that have got another meeting in the next 20 minutes. So we will go back now to the item on the annual report and the legacy report. Let me just get the content advisor to take us through. I'm sure the understanding is that it is just an introduction of this document.
Yes,
and then you should not find yourself having a field day to us. Okay? And then within the next 15 minutes, by quarter past, you should have gone through what you want to say. Thank you. You may proceed.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and good day, Honorable members and departmental officials. The two documents that have been circulated, firstly the annual reports of the Portfolio Committee on Labor, and the other document is the legacy report of the Portfolio Committee, which covers the fifth parliament, that is from 2014-15 up to 2018-19. Mm. So the process of compiling this report was that we were given the templates which are required to complete. And that is what we have done. We have filled in some of the information, and then we expect members to make input into this report. So we actually don't expect members to have input right now, but we expect them members to take these documents and go through them, and then at the next meeting then they can suggest what more information we need to add on this document.
Thank you.
The both documents are scheduled for adoption on the 21st of November. So for any inputs, I think members can just submit the inputs to the secretariat of the committee, and then those inputs will be incorporated into the staff report. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being economic with our time. And I think that's all what we have, honourable members. We must go and try and populate the document. Maybe one should check with honourable members. Last week, we had a report on the high-level panel. And then it was presented to us. And then we could not consider it because members said no, they want to make proposals of changes. Now, Secretary, have you received any comment or input from members?
Nothing changed so far.
So nothing has been made, and the possibilities that this report that we are just speaking about now, we may not make input again. So is that the Connect Advisor, you continue and populate those documents with whatever information that is there. And then whatever members will bring will be additional and fill up with their own experiences. But given the high-level panel, it looks like the possibility of not getting anything is there. It's about 51%. Yes. But then now, let me just check, Mr. Demadish. The high-level panel report, do you have it?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
Yes.
You are happy about it?
No.
Is that why you have not made an input? As agreed.
Is it that you are saying we still meet and have discussion?
No.
Okay.
Remember that last week?
Oh, okay.
Last week we met, it was delivered to us, and then there was an intent of making some input. Then we did not approve it.
Yes.
We created a space. We said Wednesday. Wednesday is the last date of making that input.
Right.
Now, Wednesday, today, we are in a meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing has happened, which means the report stands as it is. Is there anything wrong if I put the report in front of you members to approve it? Because you don't want changes and you are not making changes to it. That's what I'm just simply saying.
I'll see what the members say through you.
Yes. Let me hear from you. Are happy about the report yourself, or you still want to make any input? Come again?
I've been addressed. I have thought we should do something else. It's fine. I mean, what you are saying, Chair, and what members are saying, I'll go with. Thank you.
Honorable America, I'm sure you were not there last week.
Yeah.
But have you been made aware about the need to make input to, because it actually came from Honorable Barker.
Yeah,
he did not. And he has not indicated to you the proposal that is made. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it has been contained in the minutes that we have adopted that particular requirement. Honorable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chair. We've agreed at the in the meeting last week, Chairperson, that those who want to make inputs should do it by today. And it's also contained in the minutes that has been circulated to the members, and we all received the documents in terms of the high-level panel report via email well in advance, I think it was three weeks ago, from the secretary. So all of us are in possession of the documents, whether we were here at the committee or not, we did receive the soft copies of the document. So I would therefore propose, Chairperson, in the absence of inputs being made, I would propose that we adopt the report as is. Thank you.
Okay, it's approved. Okay, thanks. Then I'll propose that, I mean, the proposal has been made to adopt the report from Fastal Bank. Is there anyone that second that?
Okay.
And then Honorable Madisha, Honorable America, and Honorable Tombana, they are seconding. Almost there is nobody to object. Yes. Thank you. Then the report on the high level panel has been duly adopted. Honorable members, by yourselves, and that brings us to the end of our meeting today. Thank you very much for your cooperation. Long live, honorable members, long live.
Long live, Chairperson, long live.
Long live.
But then what sort of governance do you have?